Welcome to episode 19 of Behind the Shield Cybersecurity Podcast. I'm your host, Marco Estrella. Thank you for joining us today. Lots to get to today, lots of things happening in the cybersecurity world, but before we get to all those juicy hot topics, we have a new person, a new employee. A new specialist on the panel, I guess we'll call him. I'll introduce him in just a few seconds. But before I get to that, just a little bit of housekeeping. We haven't done that in a while. If you are new to the show, welcome. Take a break from your daily grind. Grab a refreshing beverage. Hang out with us for the next hour or so. Hopefully you'll enjoy the subjects that our panelists have chosen for you this week, or this month, I should say. We're all professional on the show, but I promise we're not here to sell anything to you. We're just here to discuss about what we're passionate about, which is cybersecurity related subjects. If you want to catch up on past episodes, just know you can find them by going to virtualguardian.com, or you can find them wherever you subscribe to your favorite podcasts. Now, I've mentioned the panel already today, and as usual, I will introduce them, my trusty panel of cybersecurity experts, and they are Patrick Naum, Virtual Guardian's CEO.
Hello, everyone. Glad to be back.
From our office in Minnesota, we have Bill Stroop, President of Virtual Guardian USA.
Hello, hello.
And as promised in my intro today, we have a new brave soul joining us on the panel. It's my pleasure to introduce Jason Williams to the show.
Hey, hello, Jason. Thank you, Pat. Hello, and thank you for having me.
Jason, you're new. Give us a little bit of your background, please, and what's your mission at Virtual Guardian?
Sure. So we'll start with the latter, with the mission at Virtual Guardian. Is the director of client success and solution architecture. So, working with our customers on their end-to-end strategies, working with the existing teams here at Virtual Guardian and our sister companies, as well as our parent company, on providing or bringing products and services and support to the clients that we're working with day in and day out, as well as looking at helping out with new revenue streams and bringing solution architecture up with managing the solution architects and so forth. So, really looking forward to the opportunity at hand after joining Virtual Guardian in January of this year. Prior to that, I was blessed to be at a startup for anti-ransomware, so getting into that startup world. And then prior to that, the typical things like on the big enterprises like Dell, IBM, Nortel, as well as in the partner community, where you bring a lot of the advisory and consulting capabilities that you've learned over the years from the product side and the services side. Now you bring it into the pure cybersecurity program and really being able to help customers with their strategy from, digital resilience, digital transformation, building out security programs and really leading them through their journey, 1 year, 2 year, 3 years as they build that out. And then prior to joining the pre-sale side on the vendor side, I was at the Associated Press running data centers, being on the Olympic team, Vonage, and some other things. So all in all, the net journey from when I started at 19 years old in the networking space through full-blown network security and then into full-blown InfoSec.
Nice. Very interesting. Well, welcome to the panel. Welcome to the show. Welcome to the company.
Thank you.
We're going on, 4 months already? Time flies.
Right. Time flies.
Now, our audience, they're kind of familiar with Bill and Patrick. Bill is in Minnesota, as I mentioned earlier. Patrick and I are in Montreal. Jennifer at Master Control is in Detroit. And you are, Jason, in?
Well, you'll get the Jersey side of my voice when I talk and we get ramped up. So originally from New Jersey, but have recently relocated, just outside of the D.C. area in West Virginia.
Okay. Very good. Well, welcome, gentlemen. So let's start off with our hot topic segment. We have several stories for our audience today, and some of them I can't wait to get to. So let's start off with Patrick. You're up first. There was an important announcement concerning critical infrastructure. This was a very serious announcement. So fill us in on the details, please.
Thanks, Marco. By the way, I have to ask a question today. Did any of you ever cross the Baltimore Bridge?
I have many times.
I have not.
I did not cross that many bridge. Times, no.
Between New York and Washington, right?
Well, the Key Bridge actually is one of the major bridges to get around the Baltimore area, especially when traffic hits. So, and it's over one of the major ports coming in. So it's a significant corridor for a lot of the locals as well as travelers going northbound, southbound.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
It's funny. A lot of, like, because there's a tunnel as well, right, in the area. So all the dangerous goods go on the bridge.
That's right. Uh-huh.
I wonder what's going to happen after that, because they can't, they're not going to be rebuilding it in a couple of months, right?
No.
It's crazy.
No.
Was anything said? Because CNN is reporting that the boat has called for a mayday before it hit that pillar for the bridge. But I don't want to speculate here, but they didn't say anything concerning cyber attack or anything like
officially.
That.
No. Not official.
Oh. Okay. All right.
But, it's still very sad on what happened and those affected. But it was at a time where, traveling was a little bit less than normal. Right. It was in the evening, late night instead of dayside. Dayside would have produced more horrific results.
Yeah, there's rockers on the bridge as well that fell to the water. Mm-hmm. It's terrible. I had to mention it. So our thoughts are with all the families and people that are directly and indirectly affected by this this morning. I woke up and that's the first thing we heard all over. It's actually, I'm not going to say a good segue. It's just a segue in the critical infrastructure conversation, right? Because that's what we're talking about today. So the advisory was sent on February 7th by CISA, the U.S. government, and all the other departments of the U.S. government, but also the Five Eyes, which work together, which is New Zealand, Canada, the U.K., and Australia, which are part of that network, of collaboration worldwide. So what they were able to detect over the last while was a cyber actors known as the Volt Typhoon, which were directly related to the People's Republic of China as state-backed hackers and operators that infiltrated U.S. critical infrastructure organizations. And what's interesting here, and it's actually when you listen to the story, like I was thinking of like maybe dozens of science fiction movies where, and even just wartime movies where you have lingering vulnerabilities or bad actors or traps or, any form of disruptive or potentially disruptive behavior just waiting in the background to be activated in the case of geopolitical conflict or war, right? So behind enemy lines, the ability to disrupt. And this is exactly what happened. So they detected presence in all the critical infrastructure of dormant vulnerabilities and dormant code and dormant, actors' activity, if you will, are with the ability to at any given time activate and disrupt critical U.S. infrastructure, not just in the U.S. but also in other countries as well that are part of the West, including the Five Eyes, and. In this business, if you're not learning something new every day, you're like, you're way behind or you're regressing. And one of the things I learned while, reading this notice, and then when you think about the notice and what I'm going to talk about in a couple of minutes, the recommendations are pretty much recommendations we would give or anyone would give, any cybersecurity professional would give to any business leader today, right? And we'll get into that because it's worth repeating. But the white paper that came out from CISA is really, it's labeled as action for leaders. So if you're a leader in any organization, whether it's critical infrastructure or not, you need to be cognizant of this. So my learning was the living off the land techniques, right? I didn't know that terminology until I read about it. And I'm going to go through what it means. So Volt Typhoon does not rely on malware to maintain access to networks or conduct their activity. Rather, they use built-in functions of a system. This technique, known as living off the land, enables them to easily evade detection. So to protect against living off the land, organizations need a comprehensive, multifaceted approach, right? It's because of this, it's like, it's like camouflage to a certain extent, right? Being a chameleon. So they're there, they're lingering, they're going to use systems that are in place. So usually evade standard detection. So living off the land techniques is what I was learning, what I learned during the article. So that was quite interesting. And then you go into the recommendations, right? Continuous cybersecurity training and skill development for your people. That's standard procedure when we talk to our clients, have comprehensive security plans, run many tabletop exercises is one of the other recommendations relating to that. These are things that will help you in these situations. But they also went on to spend more time on securing your supply chain as well, right? Because we look at our environments as being self-contained, controlled by us, but we're consuming APIs, applications, we're depending on either software supply chains or even, you know, normal supply chains to operate. So you also have to be cognizant of potential disruptions in your supply chain as well. So you could, your output could still be there during an attack, right? So having proper risk, vendor risk management, you know, came out as one of the key elements to track as a recommendation. So for instance, even going so far as to ensuring the responsible people around procurement to exercise due diligence around when they select software, devices, CS cloud service providers or managed service providers, and they come up with the famous secure by design principles. Make sure that the solutions and partners you deal with are secure by design, that they comply to reduce the availability of the attack pathways or attack surfaces that these threat actors can leverage. Also making sure that the vendor has a continuous patching plan, right? The ability to very quickly update based on vulnerabilities being detected and not just have software develop once and, you know, maybe not have the proper ways to keep everything up to date. Identify and limit usage of any products that break the principle of least privileged access. So everything around zero trust architectures is another recommendation as you're building your systems out and deploying them to make sure that those concepts are not just, you know, in force, but have the ability and the feature set to be able to leverage least privileged access when needed. And obviously, this is funny, right? When they say select vendors that enable interoperability, that's fine. As a best practice for resilience, and avoid vendor lock-in. That's nicely said, but vendor lock-in, I mean, whether, you know, the cloud providers or hyperscalers keep telling you, oh, come to us, you know, you're not going to be locked in, you'll be able to move wherever you want. Well, that's not, we know that's not true. You know, they're, well, the moment you choose a select, there's pain in changing your vendor. So you could alleviate that pain. There's ways to do that, but it's very hard to you know, avoid vendor lock-in. Everyone, you're locked into in someone else's vendor, but not to your own, you know, as if you're a vendor that's speaking, no one is locked in to the sales rep or the company the sales rep represents that you're dealing with. And drive the cybersecurity culture across your organization, right? Make sure that, and this is actually very, very important, especially in critical infrastructure, because we often see the silos between IT and OT. Right, operational technology versus IT. They're sometimes unrelated. They don't talk to each other. They're separate, and sometimes it's good because it creates a sense of isolation on OT. But in other cases, there's the acceleration of innovation, you know, OT wants to modernize and be more efficient. So they kind of open their kimono to the IT side of the equation, but it opens up vulnerabilities. So ensure collaboration between IT, OT, cloud, cybersecurity, supply chain, and business units. That's critical. Everyone has to be well orchestrated as they're addressing risk together. You know, championing organizational cybersecurity risk assessments and audits. The key word here is organizational, not just departmental or by function. Right. Uh-huh. And engaging with external cybersecurity experts for independent assessments. You know, and I would add myself in all this, you know, don't avoid putting all your, instead of the vendor locking, I would have said, don't put all your eggs in one basket. You know, you're dealing with a hyperscaler for applications and productivity, do you also want to, without naming anyone, do you also want to give them responsibility for your security?
Virtual Guardian SOC offers monitoring and detection of your company's activities on known malicious sites. No matter where the threats are hidden, no matter what they are, Virtual Guardian is here to protect you. Visit virtualguardian.com to learn more about our 24/7 dark web monitoring.
Awareness.
Patrick,
go ahead.
Does the article or the disclosure say anything about that living off the land? To give any examples, is it really exploiting like design errors, design flaw, security flaws in software, in systems? Or
it's functional flaws. So it's not necessarily, you know, vulnerabilities, the way software and solutions have been built. Now, it's probably not easy to live off the land. You know, we make it sound, you know, easy, yeah. But it's probably
like it's a bunch
difficult.
Of farmers, you know, gathering crops.
Yeah,
you know?
But yes. But if, I mean, some of the systems, if looking at critical infrastructure systems that I've seen, it's amazing what you can find using Shodan or other tool sets that allow you to live off the land, because there are hard coded usernames and passwords. Okay. There are aging sure. systems that yeah. allow you to basically get a foothold and really don't have to do anything to maintain that foothold moving forward. So
it's about collecting intelligence on your target for the most part.
Right. Agreed.
Not exploiting a malware.
Agreed. But you also look at it at the core of our infrastructure. Our infrastructure and a lot of infrastructures in other countries wasn't built with networking and communication in mind. It wasn't built with the internet in mind. So it was bolt on after on try to get them to become smart as we moved into this new era of, this connected area across the board. So going in and doing the normal assessments of a critical infrastructure, and you're like, okay, well, how do I really assess a PLC, a programmable logic controller? It's kind of hard to do that. And then with the reliance more and more from where we're going as we move forward on electricity and things like that, from cars to smart grid, water systems, et cetera, it's a big toll that the infrastructure now needs to, instead of being bolted on to get to a secured environment, it needs to be redesigned and then have those different capabilities built into the infrastructure itself, instead of taking the infrastructure at its core and trying to expand it, because it wasn't built to do that. So there's a ton of vulnerabilities and the ability to live off the land, because there's no visibility to the extent as we're used to seeing in programs that have been built from scratch.
Absolutely. The challenge though is, you know, from a budgetary perspective, that's a lot of heavy lifting, right? You're ripping and replace. You have to, in some cases, rip and replace. And you're mentioning the PLC example, you know, it's very difficult to assess without, you know, disrupting your production line.
That's right.
You know,
that's
right. So it's very complex. And the last component, I'll finish with this, is incident response, right? That has to be part of your plan. And it connects back to the tabletop exercise comment I had earlier. But it's they're complex problems, because the scale at which our critical infrastructure is deployed, to your point, Jason, and Bill, with your talk about those different tools, there's a lot of work to do still, and you can only patch and work around so much.
That's right.
All right.
And there's only certain ways you can patch. So how do you get that to go, right?
We can keep talking on this, but we have more topics, gentlemen, so we're going to move on. Thank you very much, Patrick. Very interesting. Yes. We're going to go now on to Bill. Bill, you wanted to talk to us about an attack on the U.S. healthcare system. What are the details that you have for us?
In fact, it's been described as the most significant attack on the U.S. healthcare system in history. So before I dive into a lot of those details, I think it's important for people to understand a couple components of the U.S. healthcare system. We've got two different major components as it relates to our systems. There's the providers who you go to for your healthcare services. And then there's the payers, the private insurance companies, Medicare, Medicaid, and so on, which is basically the funding source for hospitals, clinics, and so on, who actually provide the services, provide prescriptions, and so on. And the attack that happened impacted one of the largest processing components for the payer side, the payer network. It's a company called Change Healthcare, part of United Health Group. And they handle one of three U.S. records, or basically a third of the records of the United States, as it relates to our healthcare system, our provider system. So as a result of this attack, patients, they could not get their coverage verified. So services are being basically denied until they can actually validate whether you have insurance. People are paying cash for medicines or vaccines, or simply going without. tools that come in place, like voucher systems for pharmacy discounts, those are not available. And not only to mention that, but PII data has most likely been exposed through this particular attack. To make matters worse, on the provider side, the people actually providing the healthcare service to us as patients, they're having to slash expenses because there's no revenue, there's no income coming in. So therefore, they can actually maintain their bills, pay right. their people, and so on. So they have to slash their expenses. They have to look at actually using personal cash if they have the capabilities to do so. They're taking out lines of credit. And as absurd as it sounds, they're mailing back claims to Change Healthcare. Wow. So they can at least get in queue to make sure that those particular claims are actually getting paid.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, it's a crazy disruption and shows the fragility of the U.S. healthcare system and how the control of just a handful of organizations can impact the care of one third of the United States population. So going to the attack itself, not a lot of details on the attack itself. United Healthcare or Change Health said that it was a foreign state actor. Wired magazine reported that this was a that there was a $22 million transaction, most likely from a ransomware payment to Black Hat or ELF-D. So we at least have at least some sort of insight or some inference as far as what the attack could have been on the onset. But this attack's been going on for about 4 weeks now. And as of 5 days ago, out of the 110 services of Change Healthcare's IT infrastructure, 110 are still out of service, and only 20 of those particular services have been restored. We don't know what those services are, but it shows, I mean, for lack of a better word, a lack of preparation for this type of attack. Patrick, you just talked about the importance of doing tabletop exercises and so on. I know that they wish they would have done a couple tabletop exercises last year to prepare for this.
But who's ultimately responsible for this? Who's coming out and saying, you know, we're going to make you whole on this and we're going to address the issues, you know?
Well, it's a subsidiary of United Health Group. And this is, I think 2022, I think it's a $13 or $14 billion organization. I'm being cautious because they're in our community here, but they're the ones responsible. They acquired Change Health as part of the United Health system. So as far as who's responsible, it goes to United Healthcare. But as far as what we're doing about it, needless to say that lawmakers, patient groups, and others have been pressuring the U.S. government for relief. So there's been advance for payments that have been being sent out. United Health Group themselves has started setting up accelerated payments to both the providers and other folks that are responsible for getting that care to people. But again, it just shows the vulnerability of our system. It's an interesting article. I've covered it really quite quickly, but it blew my mind when I saw this article and said, okay, that's definitely my topic for Behind the Shield, because the network itself, you think it's so vast in the United States as far as our healthcare, but realistically, when it comes down to making sure that we can get validated for insurance and then make sure that we can submit a claim, there's just not that many organizations in that entire process. So I do think one of the outcomes in the end is going to be probably a bit of a breakup. I have a feeling that there's going to be maybe a change as far as the processing components. We will see, but I know that this is a major topic being discussed right now.
You talked about supply chain, software supply chain, process supply chains. It's an example of that.
Yep.
Well, I can go on record to, you know, say I agree with Patrick and his topic that he mentioned, as well as all those points. And now for Bill, agreeing with him, you know, just so we're on record there, because you couldn't see us nod. But with that being said, if we look back even in 2022, to be correct, we look at it from the fact that healthcare saw a 755% increase in attacks against healthcare organizations from adversarial groups. just in that year alone. So the amount of activity and the amount of threats that are building up against them, as well as we saw some of our first deaths that were associated with ransom attacks that crippled healthcare organizations. So it's significant. Yeah. And it ties back to even what Patrick, you were talking about when it came to critical infrastructure. It's got to be evaluation, assessing, building controls around it. And the same thing on the healthcare side, evaluating our controls as quickly as possible on a better cadence or monthly cadence to be able to identify threats and vulnerabilities so we can protect not only the infrastructure in these healthcare institutions, but also the life that they're supporting.
No, Jason, it's a really good point. I also think when you look at the healthcare attacks, historically, most of them have been on the providers themselves, the hospitals, the clinics, and so on. But it shows that on the payer side, this is also a deadly attack. People can't afford their chemotherapy treatment to pay it out of pocket. People are scrambling to find their day-to-day medicines and so on. So this is also most likely causing deaths out there, very serious cyber breach. And, unfortunately, I do think that there are some really tough lessons learned that people need to pay attention to. Again, check your backups, check your restore capabilities, right. Make sure that you have resiliency built into your networks, et cetera. So those are the things I'm sure Change Healthcare wish they could have gotten right through the process of that attack.
And we have to remind people, if I may jump in, is that a lot of these tasks are not heavy lift. They're not complicated. Validating your backup, doing test restores. There's a lot of low hanging fruit out there. And people see, challenges. They see things like a mountain sometimes instead of trying to, get started, break things down in more consumable projects. And you could move the needle substantially and reduce your risk as a percentage by doing some small things sometimes. But sometimes we're paralyzed because a lot of organizations don't know where to start or don't know who within the organization is responsible for what.
That's right.
Coulda, woulda, shoulda, guys.
That's right. We say in New York area, when it comes to a New York style cheesecake, it's one fork at a time, right? That we eat that great piece of food. So, but to your point, then how do you rotate back to, how do you protect the person, the individual? So you have the payment side that's been compromised, but what's working its way back to the individual through connectivity and things like that? Now you got to be looking at, how do I lock down my life lock? Address credit, things that I'm using to do those payments that on the payment side may be compromised, but how do I protect myself from personal attacks monetarily?
Good point. Thank you very much, Bill. Thank you, gentlemen, for the comments. So let's move on to Jason. So your first hot topic ever is about an SEC disclosure coming into effect. Give us the details, please.
Yeah, I think it's significant. We just talked about critical infrastructure and healthcare attacks and so forth, but pivoting more towards the policy side of the house, when we look at the SEC and how are they protecting investors now, which I thought was very interesting, that organizations that are public are now starting to have to disclose breaches in a timely manner. So if you look at the typical style of an attack and the breaches that have occurred, a lot of organizations had about a 72-hour response or public disclosure of the breach to some effect, right? It didn't have to be all the information out there, et cetera, but they had to disclose, especially if data was compromised, user information, PII, PHI, et cetera. We're all used to that from the security program side. But now looking at it from a public disclosure, there's two components to it. Through this SEC commission that's been stating these guidelines that really have been taking effect in 2024, a requirement to disclose material cybersecurity incidents 4 business days after a public company determines the incident is material, and a requirement to disclose annual information regarding cybersecurity risk management, strategy, and governance. So I have to disclose as a public entity that a breach has occurred 4 days after that, after, not after it's happened, but we're going to talk about what materiality looks like. So it's actually after all the information's been consumed, whether it's been internal or through law enforcement, third parties, et cetera. But once that materiality is documented, then there's a 4-day due diligence and due care to provide a response publicly that the that our organization has been compromised if you're operating in that public manner. And then also, you have to provide evidence of how you're working through your cybersecurity program from a risk management strategy and governance perspective, all to provide investors with the ability to make educated decisions on whether to invest or not, based on the tangible and intangible aspects of an organization through these breaches that may have occurred. So, Jason, very significant as that overview. Go ahead.
Are you enjoying Behind the Shield? Enjoy it more without commercials. Watch us live without interruption by registering for our virtual event each month. Visit virtualguardian.com/event and check out what's planned for the next Behind the Shield. Remember, when you're behind the shield, you're ahead of the game.
I have a question, and I'd like you to reiterate something you said, because it's not clear. Initially, when this came out, it wasn't clear for me, and I'm sure it's not clear for a lot of people. The delay is once you've established materiality, right? It's not once the breach has occurred. Could you say it again and clarify that? Because it's important.
That's right. It's not what we, under certain guidelines, you have 72 hours to report a breach due to the PII, PHI of users being affected, anything like that. But in this aspect, when it pertains to the SEC and really tying back to the investors, it's when all the information has been gathered. They've gone through the review with their the artifacts that they've been able to, you know, capture and comb through, working also with law enforcement, et cetera, if that's also been in their
IRR. This could take days, right? This could take quite a few days.
Yeah. That's right. It could take days. It could take weeks. But once that's determined, then they have a four-day response to get that out. And so that kind of ties into the three aspects of this compliancy with the SEC commission, which is what must be disclosed. The final rule requires public companies to disclose the occurrence of a material cybersecurity incident and describe the material aspects of the nature, scope, and timing of the incident, as well as the material impact or reasonably likely material impact of the incident on the company, including its financial condition and results of operations. Again, now giving that investor full visibility to an extent into what that looks like so they can make educated decisions on whether to invest or not. But there's also when it must be disclosed, which is public companies must disclose, must provide the required cybersecurity incident disclosure within 4 business days after the company determines the incident to be material. The deadline is not 4 days after the incident occurred or is discovered. And then that ties back to your question, when?
Okay.
Now, the materiality, and I hope I'm saying that correctly, at least that's the Jersey tone of that, determination necessitates an informed and deliberative process. So there is certain aspects of what that materiality looks like to be able to provide that response. So and Jason, the other piece, go ahead.
This is in effect now, right? This year, March 13th?
Yes. So it was discussed last year. I mean, they've been going through this for a while, dating all the way back to 2010, 2011, and working its way through 2018. But then there were specific guidelines of what that cybersecurity breach looked like, but it never rolled back to what the investor side could determine. So now it's come out last year, December timeframe, in the SEC of 2023 report, and now taking action and becoming the guideline moving forward for 2024. So very interesting. And then why use a materiality standard? They talk about, you know, I also have heard some people perhaps less familiar with the federal security laws asking why the standard for disclosure here is limited to material cybersecurity incidents. Some seem to prefer a more bright line rule, but materiality is a touchstone of securities laws. So it's also going to a what they call a an instruction or a Form 8, which is 8K, which is how things get disclosed. So they're tying this type of response back to what other informative or public disclosures have been around regular securities overall.
Are there any guidelines, Jason, as far as what materiality is, what is determined to be materiality? Uh-huh. So, you know, if someone in payments gets phished and they send out $2,000, that's probably not material, but Where are they drawing the line to say, yep, this is now considered a material breach or material issue?
They state that it's still up to the organization to decide, as well as how they remediate. But what they said in addition to this was, with the material that you do provide, they also don't want you to provide so much information that an adversary sees that information and can initiate another attack on the organization. So they want to know how it happened, the materials, how the compromise happened, what that entailed to a certain extent, and then how you remediated it. But in the public disclosure, they don't want you to be at a risk based on that public information that could result in further compromise or, a net new attack against the organization. But again, all of this is tying back to trying to get aligned with other securities publications around that form 8-K or 8K.
That's the form for the disclosure.
That's form for the security side that they're kind of trying to stay in accordance with. But this is a net new SEC regulation for the materiality of a breach
and
the reporting of that breach.
I see. Okay. All right, Jason. Thank you. Very interesting.
We're going to
move on to our fifth topic of the day. We have
yourself.
Sorry, no, fourth topic of the day. I'm sorry. No, I'm on vacation today. I'm just the host today. We're going back to Bill. Bill, you wanted to touch on some key lessons learned in the Microsoft password spray hack. What happened there?
Yeah. So on the password spray attack, everyone has heard by this point Microsoft was attacked and it was determined to be primarily through password spraying, which is basically a process of doing brute force attacks against accounts. So the article that is referenced, it's not, I'm going to just tell everyone that's been in security for a while, none of this is ground shattering, earth shaking, whatever it might be. But the biggest thing that they talk about is don't forget to protect all accounts. That's the first thing that they discuss. If you have a low level service account, or you have most of your efforts put into protecting your privileged accounts, maybe a better way of looking at it, protect everything. It doesn't matter what the level of privilege is, whether it's an admin account or something that's simply used for your daily vulnerability scans, protect all those accounts. But the points that they make on the low level accounts or inactive accounts is usually those accounts are outdated from a password policy perspective, or could potentially have weak passwords associated with them. They're also often usually unmeasured within the organization. So if they see activity on a low-level account or a low-level service account, they don't worry about it too much. The other thing that is mentioned in that article is that the account, regardless of privilege of the user, can be used as an entry point to either gain or escalate privileges on a system or use that across the network to look for additional privileges throughout the environment.
Right.
So number one, protect all your accounts.
And what do you mean by protecting, Bill? Could you please specify? Because there's a few things that were forgotten there, right?
Absolutely. So by protecting your accounts, and it goes into the other part of the article, is one, audit your Active Directory. Make sure you know what the accounts are, which ones are active or inactive. Possibly consider getting rid of even the inactive accounts. But basically have a good AD inventory and make sure that you understand what those accounts are and what you can clean or disable. Make sure that you do that.
On a regular basis, right?
On a regular basis.
That's
ongoing.
Right.
You got it. Number two, robust policies for your passwords. There are a lot of people out there still allowing QWERTY type passwords, meaning going up and down the keyboard. It's easy. It's something I can remember. If I start with number one, maybe with the shift key held down and go to Z and then back up again. What a wonderful password that is.
By the way, if I may, for a bit of research on the PRC article I had, I went to the CISA website, and Jen Esterly, as you know, is in charge of CISA. and she's there. The video, like on the front page, you see her and one of her cybersecurity experts, and they have a video. They're being, you know, filmed, and the only subject of their clip is passwords and password management. This is the head of CISA. Awesome.
Well, it shows the fact that passwords are still important because it's our primary key into most things. But needless to say, enforce complex passwords. The second key that they definitely recommend is MFA. So if you don't have MFA turned on, multi-factor authentication, almost every platform gives it to you for free to turn on, whether you're a Microsoft shop, Google shop. It's there for a reason. Simply enable it and move forward. And then last but not least, Patrick, what they recommended was compromised password scans. So as you get notifications that an account's been compromised, oftentimes you'll find through, Jason mentioned LifeLock, but there are other solutions out there that will find compromised accounts as well as the password that was associated. Make sure that you understand that people will often reuse their passwords. So even though you might have changed that password in Active Directory, they might still be using that password in your applications or other systems across the environment. So check across that entire identity. Is that password being used anywhere else other than just the Active Directory account? Because there's a good chance that it is, based on the fact that humans don't like to remember too many things. So if we can have our favorite password, my dog's first name and my last initial. Wonderful. Off we go.
So I must be on the chopping block for that as the newbie here at Virtual Guardian, because I got the password policy sent to me when Bill was working with me on an account and he saw my password. So I see how that's going for this topic. But no, in all seriousness, you're right.
Password rotation. W, that was your password.
That's right. Yeah. J-Dub, and then every shift through 1 through 9. So, but when you look at that, you know, not only MFA, but password rotation, you know, the typical things in a password policy that need to be implemented and signed off on when you join an organization. But also there's a number of times where OTPs have been given and people have a one-time password that doesn't expire. So what's the rotation on that? But again, you know, the privileged access solutions that are out there where you have to check out a password to get in, that's critical, especially when you're working on the critical infrastructure side, whether server, VM, or, you know, as we talked about earlier, the critical infrastructure that has been bolted on for security. So significant.
Like you said, Jason, because that was the last thing I was going to say. It was not in the article, but I absolutely recommend using password management solutions. So there's a lot of great solutions out there that will rotate those service accounts for you. Check them out, check them back in. Next time around, the password's different.
Could you remind us who's the company, what company we're talking about in this article again?
Exactly.
Microsoft.
Okay. So just
and you're, I know where you're going with that comment, Patrick. It's, I was saying, like, it's so basic. It's so basic things. It's like, wow.
Do you need to report a cyber threat? Virtual Guardian's emergency response team can take immediate action. Responding and recovery are vital to ensure your business critical services are maintained. Visit virtualguardian.com and click on Report a Cyber Threat in the upper right hand corner, or call us at 1-800-401-TECH. That's 1-800-401-8324.
I'm going to mute myself, but just before I do, I'm going to thank Bill, and I'm going to give you the mic, Jason, for your second topic. And this one I've been waiting for all day, a subject that many people are wondering about: repatriating cloud data back to on-premise. What's up with that?
Yeah, so, you know, as we talk about on the East, you know, drop that beat, and we're going to rewind it old school and go back a little bit. But this was very interesting to me. So there were comments back in years ago when the proliferation of the cloud was happening and folks were looking to get to cloud, trying to understand how they could actually migrate on-prem to cloud, et cetera. There was a lot of services that started to go around that on those migration strategies. And then there were some reports coming out about by 2030, we're going to see the cloud and, you know, proliferation move back to on-prem. And all of a sudden, when you said, you know, I need a second topic and what to look for, all of a sudden in Forbes, I see this cloud repatriation of, I got my data in the cloud, but I need to bring it back on-prem because there's things that we talked about when we were migrating to cloud on how we could save migrating to the cloud. You know, we're paying so much in infrastructure, power cooling, racks, maintaining hardware. And we always talked about the CapEx and the OpEx side of the operating model when we talk about our infrastructure and then what it would be like moving to the cloud side. And so with that being said, I'm reading this article and we kind of knew things were starting to take shape on the cost structure of how expensive it really was. But now mm-hmm. A lot of organizations are thinking about it. So not just the fact that companies before, and that's why I said drop the beat and rewind it back. We were talking about data centers and moving them out to cloud. We had to justify that our infrastructure, especially even on the virtualization side, we were only using 20% capacity of the infrastructure in those data centers at any given time. So virtualization came in where we tried to get to 80% utilization on that compute, that storage and the networking, yep. et cetera. And then we migrated that to cloud and kind of replicated that. But folks were like, we're going to save so much money going to the cloud. And that really wasn't the case. And even CSPs or cloud service providers said, it's not always a cost reduction moving to the cloud, but more of ease of operation, agility, better utilization, utilizing cloud service provider expertise on how to secure that and become more secure compared to what a lot of organizations had with their full-time employees resident in their environments. But I think now with who generates the data based on this article, when they start to look at not just cost, but who owns the data, who created the data, it's still the responsibility of the organization, not the CSP. So when we talk about processor controllers and all the other definitions that come about from Cloud Security Alliance definition when we're training on cloud, but organizations like, I own the data, I'm responsible for the data. And now I have this explosion of data that it's not really the compute side that's costing me the money now, it's the storage side of it. And so those storage costs are going up on how long I need to store that data based on regulations and frameworks that I abide to based on my organization's vertical that I'm in. But also, how do I get that data back? So now you look at, Patrick, you talked about it. I go into the cloud and I want to be agnostic and do workload migration. But if I build an AWS on AMI, those Amazon machine images are tied to Amazon. Really can't move them over to Azure, GCP, et cetera. Yeah. So there's a cost there. But also when I store that data and I put it in Glacier or I have all these different tiers in the cloud on how to store data, they also charge me for getting the data back out.
Yep. So it's now Hotel California.
That's right. So now we're now we're starting to see these organizations where they're going, I need to run a hybrid, a true hybrid. I have to have a certain portion of infrastructure back on-prem. So I need to reevaluate data centers, power cooling, cost of maintenance and so forth on compute, storage, networking, et cetera. But I also need to have data replication flowing back and forth so that I'm not incurring so much cost now in the cloud world that I was not expecting because it was always the mantra, well, when we move to cloud, we're going to save. And, a lot of us early on talked about that's not really the case. You know, don't just base it on cost, but a lot of organizations did.
It's all about designing the proper architecture for your workloads. Instead of thinking of moving a whole data center, we have, and that's what we're telling our clients, you have to think and evaluate the propensity to go to cloud or not for each individual workflow, process, and application. Because there's dependencies you need to look at as well, right? And you have modes of operation. You have steady state modes that are predictable and don't grow over time. And then you have the elastic requirements of certain applications that are maybe more, that have better propensity to run efficiently in the cloud. So I think to your point, there was a rush to the cloud without too much thinking and other surprises from a cost perspective. And as you know, we also have the blind spots from a cybersecurity perspective because your attack surface is increased by the same process, right?
That's right. And then you talk about, so really the four drivers of this move back to possibly on-prem has been, number one, driven by cost. But they talk a lot about internal policies. They talk about storage needs that we already talked about, and then better control. And I think the better control is also going to dovetail in strategically, because your data is not where you think your data is in the cloud.
Yeah.
So tracking where your data lives and then who has access to that data from a user or an external entity. You know, we always talked about shadow IT, and that's where the CASB, you know, mantra came in with the Zscalers and the Netskopes of the world, getting visibility and control over my users going to cloud and going to my applications that are out there. But now it is, well, how do I know where my data is, and how can I put the right controls around it and the right visibility, and then to be able to report on it based on audits and things like that. So now you're starting to see the mindset shift a little bit to gain better control, visibility, policies, and cost by driving more towards an on-prem or pure hybrid cloud instead of just everything in the cloud.
I would think you can prove your compliance also by having it back on-prem in your control with your control set far greater than you can if it's in somebody else's cloud. I mean, I'm thinking about the compliance component and the records. It would drive me mad trying to say, all right, I can guarantee you we're compliant with this PII data, but if I don't own the controls, or if I own the controls but don't really fully understand the architecture, then you're unsure completely.
That's right.
Yeah. And I mean, this has been overused, but you know, the cloud is just someone else's computer.
Yes, someone else's
computer nonetheless. And it ties back to what Bill said. You know, could you imagine, you know, we talked about an account in an environment on a random user. Well, the same can be said about, you know, accounts of people running instances in the cloud, where guess what are the consequences of, you know, Netflix, which runs on AWS, having issues in terms of, identity and access. That's right. And security. You could have someone turn off services or just delete applications and workloads. Now, obviously, they have DRs and whatnot. There's ways to prevent it, but it's something more you need to do and worry about.
Well, and that's critical, right? I think we're getting back to the place we were early days where, hey, you have your operating model. You know what your cost is. You know that's pretty static. And the writer of this on this article was Peter Gregory, who was a very forward-looking person, especially on the privacy side, that I've worked with in the past, have written a number of books. So, you know, well-respected in the market, but in the cybersecurity vertical and market. But I think we're getting back to the point where if you need burst, you go to cloud. You redirect those connectivities, like for retail during Black Friday, things like that, or the elections organizations when it goes to, you know, we're getting ready for the election or breaking news. That's right. So you burst to the cloud, but you keep everything on-prem. You know, it's just funny seeing the full circle of life come back around, per se, in this area where everything was going out. And then it's just a matter of time before everything comes back into play. So, you know, to finish up this topic, it's very interesting to see this. As long as we don't reinstate Token Ring or ATM networks, I think we're good to go. I don't need the token and Fiddy come back around to me. So, yeah.
Yeah, but what we do now need is really good API security, because that's how that information is going to be accessed. Oh, yeah.
So. That's right. 100%.
Another topic. I think someone in the team wants to host a BTS couple of months out and talk about just that, API security.
Just API security. Absolutely. Jason, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So a couple of things to say. I guess we didn't mention data residency also is a benefit of bringing it back home. Easier to prove that, I guess. It's in the cloud. Sometimes that's very iffy. Another thing that came to my mind was just thinking about certain SIM products out there that we know about that are upfront, they seem very attractive in terms of costs without naming anybody. They're very, very, very cost friendly, let's say. And then sometimes consumers don't think about those storage costs in the cloud and those, all those, I'm not going to say hidden costs, but it's not.
Egress costs.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Good term.
You need that 90 days hot, but you need those 7 years cold. Sure. Yeah. No problem at all. Yeah.
That's right.
Gravity.
That's where products like Cribble and S3 buckets come into handy if you decide to stay in cloud. So
that's right.
Exactly. Excellent. Excellent. Gentlemen, thank you very much. So what do we give Bill, Patrick? Does Jason get a passing grade today? Is he a regular panelist?
Hands down.
Okay. Wow.
From a guy from Jersey, he can really speak. I mean,
I'm waiting for the golden button, the golden ticket, like, America's Got Talent.
Yeah, the listener can't see his hands move, but trust me, they're flying. So I look forward to that next time around.
Risk, Marco.
That's right. Got to up the game.
You're on the hot seat.
Simon Cowell, come on. Do you want to be a cabaret singer? So.
I want to thank our panelists today, Patrick Naum, Bill Strube, and Jason Williams, for all their insights. If you've missed any part of today's events, the show will be made available in just a few days, 1 or 2 days. Remember that you can find us wherever quality podcasts are shared. And we know that our podcast is still kind of in its infancy. We're on episode 19, as we mentioned earlier, but we have been seeing a little bit of increase in our podcast download numbers. So that's all thanks to you, our audience. So we really appreciate if you share our link and talk to your friends and coworkers about our podcasts. Big thank you for everybody for your support. And as always, remember that when you're behind a shield, you're ahead of the game. Take care, everybody.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you, everyone.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.